Welcome, I'm Rose Aguilar, and this is Your Call. Before we begin today's show, we wanted to let you know that we will be talking about very disturbing images and violence happening in Gaza. More than 33,000 Palestinians have been killed during the U.S.-backed Israeli assault on Gaza since October 7th. 13 of those deaths are children, according to Save the Children. Thousands more are injured or missing and presumed dead. Over 17,000 children have been orphaned or separated from their parents, according to UNICEF. Almost 350,000 children under the age of five are at risk of starvation. 32 people, including 28 children, have died of malnutrition and dehydration at hospitals in northern Gaza. Human Rights Watch says children in Gaza have been dying from starvation-related complications since the Israeli government began using starvation as a weapon of war. Doctors and families in Gaza describe children, as well as pregnant and breastfeeding mothers, suffering from severe malnutrition and dehydration, and hospitals ill-equipped to treat them. According to a report released recently by the Global Nutrition Cluster in northern Gaza, one in three children under the age of two are estimated to be, quote, wasted. That means a low weight to height ratio that indicates recent and severe weight loss due to malnutrition. Gaza's health system is completely collapsing. The World Health Organization reports that the Israeli military has attacked 400 hospitals and healthcare facilities. Many people are going south to seek care, but, quote, hospitals in Rafah are overwhelmed and struggling to keep up with the needs. Out of 15 hospitals in the south, only two field hospitals are functional. 8,000 critical patients need to be medically evacuated out of Gaza, including over 6,000 trauma-related patients and 2,000 patients with serious chronic conditions like cancer. Joining us are two Northern California healthcare workers who recently returned from Gaza. Dr. Mohammed Soubey is an emergency room physician in Mountain View who spent 5 weeks working in Rafah in the south. He was part of a team that treated 700 to 800 patients a day. They conducted 40 surgeries and delivered 10 to 20 babies a day. He compares the crisis on the ground in Gaza to an apocalyptic horror movie. Dr. Soubey also has family in Gaza. Hi, Dr. Soubey. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
Sandy Adler-Killen is an emergency room nurse and lactation consultant who provided support for newborns in Gaza who had no access to food. She was at a trauma center in Khan Yunis. She says, you cannot imagine the horror we saw. Hi, Sandy. Thank you so much for joining us.
You're so welcome, Rose. Thank you for doing the show.
Well, I have to say, I saw such a disturbing interview on Democracy Now! With two surgeons who just got back from Gaza. And I just want to read part of what they said, and I wonder if you both had similar experiences. Dr. Feroz Sidhwa said he was struck by the degree of violence that was being utilized, the magnitude of the injury that is caused by the U.S. bombs that Israel is using is so dramatic. He said the blast effects are just incredible. They throw the environment through the patients. And he says, I don't mean just large pieces of shrapnel, like from the tile floor, being ripped up and thrown into the people. That happens too. He said the dust, the debris, everything is embedded in the patient's skin, and it makes surgical operations impossible. They also talked about seeing children with two gunshot wounds to the head. Dr. Soubey, it was horrific to hear this, and I just wonder, did you have similar experiences during your time in Gaza?
Yeah, you know, when you enter, you don't think you'll see that magnitude of those magnitudes of injuries, and especially in children. But this was day in and day out. It wasn't like isolated incidents where we would see a child kind of showered with shrapnel, or I had a 3-month-old shot in the thigh. I had an 8-year-old playing outside shot by a quadcopter. You know, these quadcopters are like drones outfitted with machine guns with high definition cameras. And, I think when you work there, it becomes apparent that a lot of what we're seeing in terms of traumatic injuries are very deliberate and they're very thought out. Of course, you'll see these blast injuries from, you know, a 2,000-pound bomb being dropped on a neighborhood, densely populated neighborhood. But at the same time, you are seeing, you know, these drones drop missiles. You know, I had a 11-year-old boy come in with his brains blown out, his sister shrapnel sheared off her buttock. You know, these became very, very common, unfortunately. It's not something that folks that work in other war zones will tell you they've ever seen. Part of it is because it's a densely populated region. I mean, a densely populated landmass, and especially, you know, now it's divided into five slivers, and all 1.5 million people are, you know, stuck in there. But also just because of the mere fact that you realize they're deliberate targets. I don't know why that's happening, but it's gut-wrenching as a physician to practice in that environment.
To wonder, how does a three-year-old get shot in his or her thigh?
A three-month-old.
I'm sorry, a three-month-old. Yeah. Oh, my gosh.
Yeah. I mean, again, it's not like you know, traditionally we think soldiers fighting against each other, like that typical kind of conventional combat warfare. It's a very different type of warfare that I witnessed. I mean, these drones, not only are they gathering information, but they're also there to, you know, deploy missiles and shoot. I mean, we had, you know, you'll see folks walking down the street. You'll see folks, you know, picking up firewood. I had an incident where about 10 people, including children, were just picking up firewood to take back to their tents for heating and cooking. And a quadcopter came above their head and shot them. And so, you know, you cannot operate with in Gaza. If you're going to work there, you cannot try to rationalize why the military is acting the way they're acting, because it'll drive you insane. There is no rational explanation to a three-month-old being shot, or, you know, a brother and sister walking down the street and, striking a missile next to them. It just doesn't make any sense. And there's no use in investing any, you know, mental energy trying to make sense of it, but really just have to focus on trying to save as many lives as possible while you're there.
Did the three-month-old survive? Do you know?
She did. Yeah, she did, luckily. It didn't go through any major vessels. But of course, I mean, you think about, like, it's mind-boggling that you'd ever see something like that happening. But it wasn't even uncommon. I mean, it became desensitized to it. But it just became so routine to see a child come in shot. Child shot in the back, child shot in the chest. Some of them didn't make it, unfortunately. It just became very routine, almost like, you know, someone coming in. I want to say comparing it to someone coming in with like a pneumonia in a hospital. But I mean, it was that prevalent that we were seeing those kinds of traumatic injuries. And like I said, that doesn't speak to the volumes of patients that we would see from missile blasts with shrapnel injuries that really shower your body with shrapnel, little pieces of metal objects flying at high velocity, shearing vessels, you know, entering your eyes, your chest, your abdomen. And you just have to pick and choose like which shrapnel you're going to go after and remove. And really the goal is damage control. It's making sure that you know, that person survives till the next day, as opposed to try to pick out all the shrapnel out of their body.
Dr. Mohammed Soubey is an ER physician in Mountain View who spent 5 weeks working in Rafah in the southern Gaza Strip. Sandy Adler-Killen is an ER nurse and lactation consultant who provided support for newborns in Gaza who had no access to food. And Sandy, you say that you also saw so many dead children who were brought in with gunshot wounds. Can you tell us about your experience?
Yeah, so I was deployed with an organization called CADUS. It's out of Berlin, and their focus is predominantly trauma stabilization. We also did medevacs up to northern Gaza. So my time there was focused working alongside the Palestinian Red Crescent Society. We had a trauma stabilization point at Khan Yunus, and we had multiple mass casualty incidents, anywhere from 5 to 11 patients. The vast majority of them were pediatric patients, and most of them brought in either carried by family members or on the back of donkey carts. Many of them had injuries that were not survivable. We had a small crew. There were 6 of us, 2 ER trauma physicians, 3 nurses, and 1 doctor that came in with this organization, part of the international humanitarian team. But we worked alongside residents from Gaza who had been displaced themselves, who are clinicians that come every day since the war began to operate and try to support and help the survival rate of many, many mass casualties from both gunshot wounds, missiles, and bombs. My experience very much replicates what Dr. Sube witnessed. We had many, many young children from 2 years old up to 11, 12 years old brought in with, I had a 2-year-old, part of my first mass casualty incident, 8 penetrating wounds into her body. This young child, her injuries were not survivable. So we had to move on to the next child, who also had 5-6 penetrating wounds. Most of them, the entries were from the rear, and most of them were done by the quadcopters, as Dr. Sube had articulated. We heard many times we're hearing, you know, these quadcopters shooting, and we knew that we were going to be getting multiple severely injured patients coming in, and we were grateful. Honestly, we were operating out of an area, it was called the Green Zone, and this is an area that is supposed to be deconflicted, but we were grateful when, if these people were injured, they were injured in an area where they actually had access to retrieve the bodies and make it to our trauma stabilization point where they had a chance at survival. Many of these shootings were done in areas where it was more than 2 blocks, 3 blocks, 1 kilometer away from us, and there was no way to bring these victims to a facility like ours and get the treatment that they needed.
You know, I'm not familiar with these quadcopters that you're both talking about, so I just looked this up, and Relief Web has a report on this that came out in February called Israel Systematically Uses Quadcopters to Kill Palestinians from a Close Distance. It says the Israeli army has been using these small drones to fire directly at Palestinians. According to investigations conducted by Euromed Monitor, the Israeli army is using small killer drones fitted with machine guns and missiles, which are highly mobile and versatile. Their systems can automatically search buildings and create maps to identify potential targets, carry lethal or non-lethal payloads, and then carry out a variety of missions. So, Dr. Sube, for those of us who are not familiar with this, Can you tell us more about the technologies that are being used today, these killing technologies, and what they're doing to people's bodies, you know, children and adults?
Yeah, there are multiple kind of facets to look into with respect to the military technology being used. So first off, you know, for the first time, as far as to my knowledge, we're using, or the Israelis are using, artificial intelligence to try to predict where certain targets are going to be within the landmass, and also apply to that a certain ratio of acceptable civilian casualties that will be that essentially they're okay with killing alongside a particular target. And there's, you know, reports that just came out around this over the past couple of weeks. And so, you know, there's a reliance on AI technology to determine targets and, you know, the acceptable number of civilians that they're okay with killing alongside that target and kind of carry out that operation. There's also, you know, these Hermes reconnaissance planes and drones that are bigger, bigger drones than the quadcopters. They carry missiles as well and carry out precision attacks on infrastructure as well as individuals. These are similar to, for example, you know, everyone's heard of what happened with the World Central Kitchen, the convoy there. But these are carried out throughout Gaza in terms of, you know, targeting civilians. You know, with that, you get precision bombs, you get all the blast injuries that you would expect out of these precision bombs, and then some. And then, you know, compound that with the inability to deliver adequate medical and trauma care because of the deplete resources that we're provided with deplete resources allowed to enter through the border, and it just becomes nearly impossible to adequately care for a patient. And then you have machine guns. Imagine someone coming at you with a machine gun and just shooting at you from a close distance with, you know, what would the those traumatic injuries look like, right? And it's almost like I did not see any soldier while I was there, and I'm not sure if I'm pretty confident most healthcare staff that have gone to Gaza to help did not encounter any military personnel or soldiers, unless you were in Shifa or Nasir when they were taken by siege by the Israelis. And so a lot of these military operations are being carried out remotely via these, you know, drones and AI technology, which is not something, you know, like I said, as to my knowledge, we haven't really seen in recent military operations across the globe.
Dr. Soubey, half of Gaza's 2.2 million population are children. Why are so many children being killed? Is it? What is your assessment, given you were there?
I can't speak to the intentions of the Israelis. Obviously, you look at the, you know, the reality in terms of the environment. You know, you have the Gaza Strip is 2/3 the size of the city of San Jose. Divide that in five, and now you have Rafah. 1.5 million people in Rafah pushed into it, herded. And you know, they're trying to, you know, live day to day, look for food, and they're out and about. And, you know, I can't really rationalize why so many children are being killed, especially with these precision cameras. You can tell that that's a child. I can tell you from patients I encountered, many of the children that would come to me were orphaned. Their parents were killed in front of their eyes, and then they were shot after. And it almost feels like it's almost either they're trying to kill them, or they're trying to injure them so severely that they would be kind of lose their spirit. I mean, that's how it felt like. They, like, you just saw your parents get killed in front of you as a child, And then you're also going through that physical pain of being shot in the abdomen or shot in the leg. I presume they're hoping to demoralize them or cause physical and psychological trauma that is, you know, lasts their lifetime. But you see that inflicted upon this generation in thousands of children. And what you'll find from speaking to other physicians and nursing staff and whatnot, that this is very common. This is a story that they'll tell you they encountered with every pediatric patient whereby gunshot wounds were inflicted upon them. And so, again, I can't speak to the intent, but, you know, over time you start seeing patterns and you hear the stories. And we're smart enough as human beings, we have intellect to be able to piece that together. Mm-hmm. You know, there's a lot of talk that we see on the media in terms of the reports from government officials. And then there's the actions that we witness in front of our eyes. And I think, like we all know, actions speak louder than words, especially when these actions are seen now for months on end. That's all I can say around that.
Sandy, I know we have to let you go soon. Can you tell us what your experience was like working with so many newborns? You brought 30 manual breast pumps with you because of a lack of food sources, especially for newborns.
Yeah, so I'd be happy to talk about that, but I wanted to tag on to a little bit of what Dr. Sivis shared. So he's right. We didn't encounter, based on our experience, any soldiers, except when we were doing medevacs up to the northern part of Gaza. Then, you know, we were with UN transports. Our vehicles were not armored. We had a team of three that would retrieve patients, very, very fragile patients from that area. And so that was the only time that we encountered that. Also, to speak about the trauma, the ongoing trauma of these children. So our trauma stabilization point was, as I mentioned, in Khan Yunis. It was in a neighborhood where families are trying to function, trying to survive, whether they were relocated there, whether this area, some families had been living and they had not been forced out of their homes. And the children were surrounding throughout the day. They wanted to interact with us. They wanted to connect with us. And we would have many, many decomposing bodies, decapitated bodies. What these young babies, children were experiencing on a daily basis, I can't imagine in terms of the psychological impacts. Many of these, again, as Dr. Suve shared, these were orphans. We had many pediatric patients, four-year-olds, that would come in by themselves to treat their wounds. We had six-year-olds bringing their three-year-old brothers to get sutured. We had minimal amount of oxygen to use for critically ill patients because trying to bring oxygen canisters is not allowed. We had, you know, minimal resources. And then, of course, these critically ill patients are being transported to hospitals where, you know, Dr. Suve, I'm sure, operated. And the resources there are limited again. So it's unimaginable trying to provide the kind of medical care necessitated by the level of injury, the level of trauma, and having so little to be able to support this community, this population. And the clinicians that I, again, worked side by side with were incredible. You know, these are people, again, that have been forced out of their homes multiple times and coming in day after day after day to provide care to, you know, most of the clinicians I work with were nurses and physicians in their 20s. So the trauma they're experiencing. And then to just share about lactation. So, I was able to bring in manual breast pumps, and they were distributed to two facilities, the NICU that's operating out of Emirates Hospital, and then NICU that is in Al-Aqsa Hospital. And many of these babies, they're five to an incubator, mothers have been killed, lack of formula if that was the only source available. And then, of course, trying to provide milk to your newborn when you're traumatized, when you're malnourished. So the manual pumps were a support to be able to provide additional nutrition. We also had multiple births in our tent, and I was able to support newborns and mothers with being able to breastfeed in situations that were, again, unimaginable. So,
Sandy, are you planning to go back?
I would love to go back. One of the most difficult things was leaving my colleagues there. I'm communicating with them on a daily basis. My heart is there with them. If it's possible, I'm hoping to go back in June. I applied for another mission. And if it happens, yes. And my focus at that point, if it's possible, will be predominantly on lactation support.
Well, thank you so much for the important work you do, and thank you for joining us, Sandy.
Thank you so much.
Sandy Adler-Killen is an emergency room nurse and lactation specialist who provided support for newborns in Gaza who had no access to food. She was at a trauma center in Khan Yunis, and she says you cannot imagine the horror we saw. Coming up after a break, we'll continue speaking with Dr. Mohammed Soubey, an emergency room physician in Mountain View who spent 5 weeks working in Rafah. He was part of a team that treated up to 800 patients a day. They conducted 40 surgeries and delivered 10 to 20 babies a day. He compares the crisis on the ground to an apocalyptic horror movie. He also has family in Gaza. This is Your Call. We'll be back after this. This is Your Call. I'm Rose Aguilar. Coming up in about 10 or so minutes, Wend Kaufman, a Jewish activist, will join us to talk about why she is joining next week's Freedom Flotilla to Gaza. Right now, we are joined by Dr. Mohammed Soubey, an ER physician in Mountain View who spent 5 weeks working in Rafah in the southern Gaza Strip. If you have any questions for Dr. Soubey about what he experienced, you can give us a call at 866-798-8255. You can also email yourcall@kalw.org. More than 33,000 Palestinians have been killed during the U.S.-backed Israeli assault on Gaza since October 7th. 13,000 of those deaths are children. Over 17,000 children have been orphaned or separated from their parents, according to UNICEF. Dr. Soubey, that's another just horrific part of all of this. What is actually happening to those kids who lost all of their family members?
Yeah, so unfortunately, for those kids, many of them don't have any remaining family members. So for those who do have, say, an uncle or aunt who can take them in, they usually will remain with them. But aside from that, you know, some of these hospitals are housing some of the orphan children. And many of these orphan children, by the way, also sustain traumatic injuries, and many of them also require evacuation for higher level of care. So at our field hospital, we were housing many children who were awaiting evacuation, either because, you know, they had an amputation of an extremity and required prostheses and rehabilitation, or because they sustained crush injuries and took out, say, half their shin, and they had a temporizing external fixator that we placed for them until they can get definitive treatment of their underlying fracture. And so, unfortunately, there's no kind of clear system as to how to best manage a lot of these children. Sometimes these children are, you know, neighbors, you know, that they grew up with. They will take them in, and so it's very difficult. It's really hard to see these children who are going through, you know, formative developmental time in their life, be traumatized psychologically, physically. You can imagine also just the mere fact that, you know, growing up without a limb has huge implications on how you are able to function day to day, how you perceive your ability to also reach your potential to get the most out of life. We had a 15-year-old with blast injuries to his extremities. We had to do bilateral amputation. So we had to take, you know, he really didn't have much left of his lower legs. And so, you know, we had to amputate up to his pelvis. And you know, you talk to him and you realize just the depressing thoughts of, like, you know, sometimes so depressed. I mean, folks would get so depressed that they'd say, like, I just wish I would have just died through all of this. Like, why did I have to live? Especially ones that witnessed their parents getting killed. This was very common. I'd hear that and it would just be heartbreaking. And I try to kind of reset their focus in terms of, like, no, we're so glad you're here. Things will get better, and trying to give them hope and optimism. But for many, it was like, what's the point of me living? Like, if I'm shot, I'm going through this pain. I'm a child. I just saw my parents getting killed. It's painful. It's not something that you're trained as a physician to break bad news, but this is not. I mean, this is like magnitudes more than just breaking bad news of someone, you know, at the end of their life, kind of passing away from, say, a heart attack or stroke or whatnot. Yeah, it's not a very clear system, but the thing about the Palestinian society, it's that we don't appreciate just from, you know, watching the videos, the social fabric is very tight. Mm. Everyone supports each other. And it's something that it's probably the biggest, you know, the biggest thing I miss after I left Gaza is, you know, we come to a society here where a lot of the focus is on me, myself, and I, and just kind of very self-serving. And in Gaza, everyone's supporting each other, whether it be, you know, I have a little bit of food, let me give it to you. Or seeing someone lose a loved one and just offering that emotional support and being there for them. Well, what do you need? And it's such a beautiful kind of collective humanity, kind of the manifestation of what it means to have collective humanity. I feel like if the world just adopted that, it would be such a beautiful world across, you know, the globe. And
I'm so glad you're bringing this up, Dr. Soubey, because I think a lot about othering. How does the world allow something like this to happen if not for othering? Oh, they're not like us. They're just all terrorists. I mean, I wanted to ask, I'm so glad you're on the show today, because something I've been bothered by is, obviously, the statistics and the numbers are very important, but the media are really focusing on the fact that the majority of the deaths are women and children, as if men in Gaza are all terrorists, or as if a dad does not love his daughter in Gaza. It's very strange to me that we're just ignoring men who are also going through trauma, who are dying, who are losing their kids and their wives and their loved ones.
Absolutely. Absolutely. I don't know when it became okay to, you know, put a value on more value on a woman's life than a man's life, or vice versa. And I think, like, we have to kind of peel back all of these layers that are imposed upon us. And just remember, we're all human beings. And this kind of reminds me of a conversation I had with a gentleman. Yesterday was Eid. It's our celebration at the end of Ramadan. And I was heading to a picnic at a local park. And as I was walking from the parking lot over, I was wearing my keffiyeh around my neck. And I was met by this gentleman who walked up to me, and he said, "Assalamu alaikum." And I said, "Wa alaikum assalam. Peace be upon you." And I said, "Eid Mubarak," greeting, you know. And he said, I don't actually speak Arabic, but, you know, I'm from France, and I picked up some Arabic words." And he asked me, "Where are you from?" I said, I'm Palestinian. And he said, "What's Palestine? You mean Israel?" And so, you know, I was met with that encounter. I said, well, Palestine, I tried to explain, but I soon realized he knew what I was talking about. And after talking with him for about 15 minutes and just refocusing on our shared humanity, we're all human beings. We come from the same place. We're going to the same place. And our journey through those two points in time is what really, really matters. And kind of we share the same pain and suffering experience, that we share the same experience of happiness and joy, kind of broke down those shackles, you know, of how he viewed me, how he viewed a Palestinian. And I think when we stop, we get to know each other as fellow human beings. We stop getting inundated with the fear-mongering that we hear constantly of, like, we're under attack or we're under threat because of this label. You know, this other person is trying to either, you know, harm me or take over my, you know, take my job or whatever it may be. Then we'll be able to connect with one another in a way that allows us to see the other person as a human being, that that human being experiences the same joys and pains of life as I do. I think the dehumanization aspect is probably the most dangerous aspect of our world right now. And we've set up so many boundaries and borders, labels that have siloed us and allowed powers that be to control us as a people, and not allow us to flourish as a human population. And so I think that's that I believe it contributes to a person pulling the trigger and killing a child, you know, or, you know, dropping a bomb to get one target when there are 40 other human lives there, that they're going to take along with it. And so, that dehumanization needs to be explored, because it's the cause of, I feel, all the evil that we see in the world right now.
Today we're speaking with Dr. Mohammed Soubey, an ER doctor in Mountain View who spent 5 weeks working in Rafah in the southern Gaza Strip. Let's take a couple of calls and then we'll welcome our next guest. Let's hear from Mark in San Leandro. Hi, Mark. Welcome to the show.
Yeah, hi. It's good to hear from these good people and good deeds. But let's look at this. You know, the Israeli state is a product of a land grab in 1947, and the emphasis, the only way you can explain people being killed and removed from the land and then destroying their homes and institutions, what's that about? It's about they're not coming back. And it's about Netanyahu and, regrettably, our president. This is okay. And because what I wanted to say is it's a land grab. It always has been. The people are collateral, like Madeleine Albright's expression, they're collateral damage.
Well, thank you for the call. I'm glad you mentioned Biden, because I wanted to ask you one question about this, Dr. Soubey. The Washington Post had a piece just a couple of weeks ago about the Biden administration quietly authorizing the transfer of billions of dollars in bombs and fighter jets to Israel. 1,800 2,000-pound bombs, 500 500-pound bombs, according to the Pentagon. I mean, these bombs are going to kill even more children, the children that you are treating or have treated. And with the World Central Kitchen horrific bombing and killing, you know, a lot of people have been talking about how that has shifted things. It took Westerners and foreigners to be killed for people like Nancy Pelosi to now call on Biden to stop transferring weapons to Israel. What are your thoughts?
Yeah, I think it kind of ties into our conversation about otherizing people, right? The fact that the world and the administration didn't wake up to the atrocities, or maybe they were awake, they just didn't care, when over almost nearly 200 aid workers have been killed since October. You know, over 400 healthcare workers have been killed. Off limits. I mean, these are doctors, nurses, staff trying to help people in hospitals. Two-thirds of the hospitals in Gaza decimated. The fact that it took foreign aid workers to be killed for them to take action or at least make a more stern statement is sad and depressing. It's a reflection of us allowing, you know, leadership to take the reins and really make decisions that are against not only our human values, our American values. I think it's, you know, I think of it this way. If a patient came to me hemorrhaging and, you know, the aide, you know, a lot of, I've met with a lot of elected officials and they'll say, you know, I'm all for like pushing in humanitarian aid. Humanitarian aid is like someone's hemorrhaging, you hand me a pint of blood and it buys me some time to try to save this patient's life. What we really need is to stop the bleeding. Stopping the bleeding is in the form of a ceasefire, is in the form of how do we establish true liberation, justice, peace for the people on the ground. But what we're seeing instead, you know, via these military aid packages is we're giving the perpetrator more weapons to inflict more hemorrhaging in the patient, you know, to stab the patient, to shoot the patient. So now they have more sources of bleeding that I have to control as a physician. It comes off as very hypocritical and kind of illogical. It doesn't kind of go in line with the what we're hearing. In terms of achieving true peace and justice and liberation and freedom for people. And so, it's a difficult pill to swallow, I think, when we hear both those things that don't go in line with one another.
Dr. Mohamed Soubey is an ER physician in Mountain View who spent 5 weeks working in Rafah in the southern Gaza Strip. Now we would like to welcome Wind Kaufman to the show. Wind is a longtime Jewish activist who is joining the International Freedom Flotilla to Gaza next week. The flotilla consists of multiple ships carrying over 5,500 tons of urgently needed food and medicine for the Palestinians. Wind Kaufman has traveled a number of times to the West Bank between 2002 and 2012, participating in nonviolent demonstrations. Israel deported her on her sixth trip, and she could not go back for 10 years. She was actually on her way to the West Bank to take part in an olive harvest on October 7th, but obviously could not continue with her trip. Wind Kaufman is a retired professor of engineering at City College of San Francisco. Hi, Wind. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
Well, can you tell us more about the International Freedom Flotilla? Because it's not getting that much major media attention.
Well, I hope that will change. And we will start doing much more aggressive outreach when the ship sails. It will be sailing soon. Right now, things are, you know, getting into place. The humanitarian aid is getting on board, all the ship's parts. And of course, weather conditions will also determine the exact date. So, it will be soon.
And how is this going to work? So this is multiple ships carrying over 5,500 tons of food and medicine.
That's right. The Freedom Flotillas have been going since 2007. Or the first actual flotilla was 2008. The organization started in 2007. This is an experienced group, and it has gotten aid to Gaza. It has also more often been boarded by Israelis, everybody arrested and deported. And in one dramatic incident in 2010, the Marvi Marmara was boarded by Israeli soldiers, and 10 people on board were shot and killed. These were civilians. These were just bringing humanitarian aid in. And it's, you know, not unsimilar to what happened with the World Kitchen team. So, but we expect that with broadcasting this very publicly, emphasizing the fact that this is a humanitarian mission and that really it's in keeping with international law and, you know, stopping a genocide, which is being perpetrated, and starvation is one of the tools of being perpetrated. And so we need to stop this.
What are you all planning to do once you get to Gaza? Because you think about the horrific attack on the World Central Kitchen convoy, and then a UNICEF worker who was on Al Jazeera this morning said that UNICEF said one of its vehicles came under fire during an attempted aid delivery to northern Gaza, and that just happened today.
Yeah, that is how Israel, you know, I have to agree with the doctor earlier who said that, you know, you can't try to imagine why they're doing this. It's just that this is what they're doing, because it's just unfathomable. It's unfathomably cruel and horrific. Yes, what you say is true, and we are putting ourselves at risk. However, we're hoping that, you know, if the world, if we get the world to be watching, and you know, they're, you know, more and more since October 7th, you know, people are paying attention and educating themselves about what is actually going on. And I think that it's increasingly being exposed, you know, especially with, you know, Western workers being killed, humanitarian workers. So you ask what we are doing when we get there. We will, you know, we will be working in concert with Palestinians on the ground who will be receiving us and helping us to offload the humanitarian aid. And then we will leave. We do not want to put any burden on Gaza. We have our own supplies for ourselves and the crew and so forth. And we will be just delivering this aid and then leaving. This is not a vacation. This is not a tourist trip. This is, you know, just delivering essential aid to, you know, stop the starvation.
People from all over the world are taking part in this flotilla?
That's correct. Yes.
The
passenger, you know, the manifest will be made public when we start sailing, but not until then.
And Wind, I just wonder, as a longtime Jewish activist, we chatted yesterday and you said that you grew up in a Jewish community. Was it in Detroit?
That's right.
Right. And then you came to Berkeley and you were exposed to people doing so much about injustice. You started activism in the early 80s, concentrating on nukes in Central America. You didn't want to touch Palestine, but then Ariel Sharon came into power and that changed everything for you. Why is this issue so important to you?
Well, it's important to me on a number of levels. One, because I am Jewish, and the state of Israel does not represent me. In fact, it represents, I don't know what it represents, but it certainly doesn't represent Jewish values. And I did grow up in a Jewish household which did value justice and truth and, you know, seeking compassion, you know, and that's just not what Israel is about right now. You know, when we, so it's important to me as a Jew, it's important to me as an American citizen, where my tax dollars are going to pay for this horrific genocide. And they've been paying for really the atrocities that Israel has been committing since its inception. And just as a human being, you know, that is looking at the suffering, I just need to do what I can to stop it.
Dr. Subay, final thoughts from you. You just wonder, how much longer can this go on?
Yeah, I think, unfortunately, it's going to go on as long as we, as the global human population, remain asleep to it. That's just our reality. Like Wynn was mentioning, this has been ongoing at, you know, to various degrees over the past 8 decades. And so, you know, when people are aware of the truth happening on the ground and speak up, use their agency for change and realize their power, the power of their voice, the power of their dollar, that's when we're going to start seeing the needle move and move faster. And that needs to happen sooner rather than later, because people's lives are at stake. Literally, in this time frame, you know, at least 10 children have been killed in Palestine right now. And so we need to realize that and internalize that and feel for our fellow human beings. Just think about, what would this mean to me as a human being if my family was killed? And I think that's really going to be the tipping point, in my opinion. Until then, we do our best to save as many lives as possible and try to bring joy to those surviving these atrocities.
Dr. Sube, are you planning to go back? And just quickly, how is your family doing in Gaza?
Yeah, absolutely. I'm planning my second mission now. And my family is as good as they can be. Constant trauma, but they're trying to survive just a day at a time. And they're doing what they can.
Well, thank you so much for taking the time to be with us today. Dr. Mohammed Sube is an ER physician in Mountain View who spent 5 weeks working in Rafah in the southern Gaza Strip. Wind Kaufman is a longtime Jewish activist who is joining the International Freedom Flotilla to Gaza next week. The flotilla consists of multiple ships carrying over 1,500 tons of urgently needed food and medicine. Wind and Dr. Sube, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you. And you can learn more about everything we discussed today. We've got links to all of the stats that we talked about and the work of the guest today at yourcallradio.org. Thanks to Savannah Harriman-Pote for producing today's show. Thanks to Kevin Vance for engineering our show. And I am going to take a much-needed vacation over the next couple of weeks. You will be in very good hands with fill-in hosts Angie Coiro and Ethan Elkind. And huge thanks to Savannah Harriman-Pote and Malihe Razazan for doing more work while I am gone. Thank you so much for joining us. I'm Rose Aguilar. It's your call.